Hello, and welcome to The Slow Revolution, the podcast where we explore the pros and cons of slowing down in a fast, impatient world. I'm Carl Honoré, your host, and my guest today is David Bond, filmmaker and father of two. And I include both those data points from his biography because they are intimately connected for this interview, because David is the man who made a film called Project Wild Thing, which is all about getting children away from screens indoors and thrusting them back out into the arms of Mother Nature. And of course, this has a lot to do with the kinds of ideas that I've been playing around with and exploring myself in some of my writing. So I'm delighted to be with you. I enjoy the film immensely, and welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Carl. It's great to be here.
It's funny, isn't it, given the subject matter of the film, that we're recording this indoors. But given that this is actually the first podcast I've ever committed to tape, I felt I needed a clean and predictable sonic environment. So
you need to pick your battles, right?
Yes.
So first of all, let's get the machinery working, and then maybe next time we'll do it in a field.
And build from there, because I did originally think, well, we should be finding a forest or a lakeside somewhere with the water gently lapping in the background. But no, I'm happy to be here in your kitchen, which is just as delightful and has a bucolic view, of course, into your garden.
Well, you're very welcome. You're very welcome. And we're very lucky enough to have, I'll describe it, we have a kitchen with some windows at the end of the kitchen, and Carl and I are looking out over our garden, which I can't take any credit for. It's my wife is very green-fingered, and it's looking particularly lovely at the moment. And although it's small, it is definitely my children's pressure release valve.
And probably not just your children's.
Probably not.
Both? The whole family's hatch, maybe?
I think that's right.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
It's a glorious garden. This is one of the things I like most about... Well, England is a kind of garden, isn't it? A green and pleasant land, and even in a big, bustling, brick-lined city like London, you find so many oases of green, don't you? It's a remarkably verdant city, I think.
It is, and I was very surprised to learn that London is, in fact, rated as one of the greenest cities. I'm always interested, if I travel to the countryside to maybe play the film in the UK, people say to me, oh, you live in London, that's where the real problem is with kids not going outdoors. Mm. That's where the real problems are, you know, in the city. And, you know, that wasn't really my experience at all in making the film. Some of the children I met who were most well connected to the natural world were city children. And some of the children I discovered who were kind of really stuck on screens a huge amount and being ferried from one place to another by their parents in cars, mm. they were living in the countryside. So, you know, I think this is one of those issues that it's easy to get obsessed with the idea that it's all, you know, that there are problems in the city. But as we just described, you know, London is a great place to have to live a green existence as a kid.
Mm-hmm. And also a place where you, as a child and a grown-up, you're probably more inclined to walk everywhere, aren't you, than you are in the countryside. That's one of the things people discover when they move out of big cities to the country, is that they find themselves driving all the time, don't they?
Well, that's really, I mean, we've got a personal kind of experience of that. My mother has been living in the Yorkshire Dales for years, and she's come to move to London now. And the place she lived in the Yorkshire Dales is so beautiful, so in the middle of nowhere, peaceful, calm. But she drove everywhere. And, you know, she's finding she's getting loads more exercise and loads more walking done in the city. So, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of paradoxes about the rural idyll.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as simple as city versus country, I don't think.
Where did you grow up? You're a Londoner, are you?
No, I was kind of half-half. I'm from Canterbury in Kent, which is, you know, a smallish city in the southeast of the UK. And I was lucky enough, I think, to have the best of both worlds. You know, I was living in a town that had stuff to do as a kid, you know, that was fun and lively and vibrant, a university town with a lot of culture. But we were kind of right on the edge of it, so we were able to step out and you're into, well, what's called the Garden of England. You know, Kent is famously beautiful and has lots of lovely places to go and explore and hang out as a kid. So, yeah, I felt like I lucked out, really.
Mm-hmm. But at some stage, you decided that your children were not having the best of both worlds. Is that right? I mean, I'm just wondering if you can walk me through the origin story of Project Wild Thing.
Yeah, I think I looked at my children a few years ago and realized that they weren't able to roam at all mm-hmm. in London. I used to roam in about a square mile in Canterbury when I was growing up. My mother, who grew up in Yorkshire in the north, She roamed in about 50 square miles as a kid. I mean, not in a particularly rural environment. This was just a normal thing. And I started talking to people and said, you know, have you noticed this, that children don't get to go anywhere anymore? You know, they're just in the back garden. My kids roam in our yard out here, which is, well, as we've said, it's nice enough, but it's pretty small. I started wondering if that was something that was playing out all around the UK. And it seemed to me that it was. And I don't think initially I was concerned about it. In fact, you know, as a younger father, I was really persuaded by the technological glories that could be brought to parenting. You know, I love the idea that the kids, maybe they'd be learning other languages because I'd be sitting them in front of the iPad and they'd be like becoming Chinese Mandarin speakers, or that, you know, that their musical appreciation would be stimulated by lots of film watching and music listening.
Did you buy a Baby Einstein DVD?
I was totally sucked into the whole Baby Einstein thing. And I think it was really beginning to research for the film and talking to people about what children lose if they're stuck inside. It's not so much that the inside and screens is necessarily bad for you per se, although I'm not ruling that out. In some ways, I think it is. The real problem is what it displaces out of normal life. So, you know, a normal kind of healthy pie chart of time for a kid 50 years ago would have had 30, 40% of time outdoors, playing outdoors. And now, well, I checked it out with my daughter and she was 4% outdoors. You know, it's a total...
It was astonishing that, to see the raw numbers, wasn't it, when it came up at 4%.
Right.
That's so little.
It's so little. It's incredible, yeah. I worked out that it's about as much time as she spent in the bathroom. Right, so, I mean, you know, that's how much we value the outdoors. Yeah. It's kind of the same time as going to the loo and having a bath. And, of course, all the developmental experts, all of the work that's being done on the plasticity of brains and the way that children's brains are so affected by their environment, and all the educational work that's has been done over the last 100 years, all points to the power of an outdoor environment to really generate, I was going to say healthy, that's probably too strong a word, but generate really successful development, emotional and physical development. The reason I didn't use the word healthy is because I don't want to say iPads are unhealthy. I think the thing about iPads and screens is that they displace a lot of really health-giving stuff.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I sometimes find myself in the same position where I'm talking about technology with children and adults and so on. And you always feel you've got to walk a little bit on eggshells so you don't sound like a Luddite, I find. And am I hearing a little bit of that unease in your couching of some of the things you say, that you don't want to be painted as the guy who's anti-iPad? Or, you know, clearly you're not anti-iPad. But I was in Silicon Valley recently and talking to people in, you know, the parents working in Google and Microsoft and so on, and asking them what they do with their children. And increasingly what you find is that they are not giving their kids iPads or iPhones. They're sending them out into the garden or into the playground to mess around and scrape their knees and fall off trees and climb them. And you're sending them to Montessori schools which don't have screens in the classroom. And Steve Jobs himself didn't give his own kids iPads or iPhones.
I think it's so interesting what those... That finding from Silicon Valley, I read some stuff about that. You know, you've got there people who are, you know, mass producing the technology that a huge number of the world's children are going to be watching. And yet, for some reason or other, they're a little bit concerned, or at least they're showing evidence of wanting to be balanced in how much of that technology their own children get. And, you know, what does that say about those guys? They're out there marketing this kit, and yet they're wary of it. And that is a really interesting insight, I think. And it makes me realize, not that it means that technology is bad, but that technology is really complicated and that it can be used for really great things and it can be used for really dodgy things. And I think we don't have complex enough language to talk about the different kinds of technology that are out there, right? Because some technology makes you very physically active. I mean, think about running apps, for example. Some technology makes you mentally very active. But then there's technology that makes you physically very passive and mentally very passive. So in a sense, you've got four kinds of technology. And the stuff that I love giving to the kids is the stuff that gets them up off their chair and into the garden to do something. So we've got apps that, you know, let them identify species, or apps that let them to, you know, sort of stargazing apps to let them check out the night sky. That sort of technology I really love. But yeah... I'm always feeling a little like I'm in competition with the marketing directors of Disney and Nintendo and Apple. They're there to try and lure our kids into watching more and more of their stuff and buying, and hence to make us buy more and more of their stuff. And I feel like it's my job to market the alternative, which is which is nature. And the great thing I can say about my product, nature, is that I really want my children to overdose on it. I don't think it's possible to overdose on it. Whereas, you know, as we've discussed, those guys marketing the tech, they don't want their kids to be on it all day long. So I think that really tells you something about the team.
Yeah. Well, of course, in the film, you dubbed yourself marketing director for nature. And you talk about taking on the big boys. It is a bit of a David and Goliath scenario, isn't it? Do you feel that you've landed some compelling blows along the way? How is the balance between David and Goliath?
As we discovered, you know, we got lots of favors in. We had huge numbers of creatives helping us to create commercials. This is all in the movie. You know, we're trying to, it's a real caper movie, I suppose. We're on this crazy mission to try and market nature, which is free. So it's kind of weird that you're marketing it because you're not normally used to free things being marketed. But it's a really fun thing to do. You know, we got a lot of help from outdoor advertising experts and companies who lent us loads of billboard space. And, you know, we were kind of doing jingles on the radio and all sorts of stuff. And, you know, we really spent quite a lot of money. We didn't actually spend it. We got it donated to us. But what you realize when you start heading down this road is just what you're up against. And, you know, the big guys with their technology marketing budgets are going to just blow you out of the water.
They have the staying power, don't they?
They have staying power.
Yeah.
And the reason that their brands succeed is because they market to us over and over and over again, and they really, you know, they get under our skin. So yeah, we've had some wins because we've made people think about the way in which so much tech is pushing nature out of the equation. So just making people think in those terms and making people think about wild time as being an alternative to screen time, and maybe an alternative that has some better selling points, like it's fun, it's free, it's really good for you. Okay, maybe you can say screen time is fun, but only for a while. It's certainly not free. And the evidence seems to be that, at the very least, it's displacing stuff that's good for you, if not being bad for you. So I like the idea of making the products stand up against each other. And we've been provocative with Apple and other big screen manufacturers and tried to get them to, you know, to come out fighting with us. But, you know, they're not stupid, right? They've got good PR people. They know they're not going to win a battle lining their product up against the natural world. So it's quite fun to provoke them because they don't tend to bite back.
Although occasionally you do see some tech companies aligning themselves a little bit with this idea of the virtues and the benefits of switching off, don't you? There was the famous ad campaign from Orange, you remember the telephone company, which was their catch line was good things happen when your phone is switched off. And of course, it sounds like a suicide note, but if they know that we're going to use our phones, they can make lots of money from it. But they also know that a new conversation is growing up around the gadgets, which is about the kinds of things that you're dealing with in Project Wild Thing, which is that there's a balance to be struck between how much time you spend plugged in gazing at a screen and how much time you do other things that take you out of the indoors and into nature. Let's go back a little bit to the beginning of the genesis of the project. So was there a trigger moment when you suddenly thought, I've lost my compass as a parent, we've lost our way as a family, and you just suddenly thought, I've got to do something about this? Was there an aha moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was looking at my children. My daughter was obsessed with this app on the iPad where she had a pet horse, and she would pet it and feed it, you know, and she was desperate to carry on doing that. And I just walked into the room one day and she was sitting there in a darkish room after school with the iPad on her lap. She was lit, you know, in that ghoulish way that you are by the iPad.
Yeah.
And she was stroking the forehead of a virtual horse and talking to it. And you know, she was 4 years old. And I kind of thought, right, we need to think about this. We need to have a conversation about this.
Yeah. Like a sort of eerie sci-fi dystopia moment.
Well, it kind of was, and I was really aware at how, you know, if I want, I can make my children have a tantrum in 1 second by switching the TV on and then switching it off again too quickly. That is guaranteed tantrum inducing behavior as a parent. You know, that never happens when, you know, if we've been outdoors for 5 minutes and I go, well, let's go run back in again. You know, they're much more relaxed about the outdoors. It puts them in a much more relaxed frame of mind. So, you know, it's a series of things that were beginning to happen in our lives as young parents. And we were thinking, or as parents of young children, we were just thinking, how do we want this to play out, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. And when you tabled this idea to your wife and then also to your children, what was the reaction? Did they think,
I didn't really,
you're going off on one here?
I didn't really, I just went for it.
Oh, you just jumped right in, right? That's probably the best thing, yeah. And pulled them along in your wake.
Well, I think my wife was really keen on it. She was fine on it. And I kind of wanted the children to see what would happen rather than like telling them this is the new way.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted just to kind of begin to see whether I could persuade them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how it began.
And then once you moved out of the family home and taking this idea out into the wild, what kinds of reactions did you find from the kind of people who'd be funding it or broadcasters? Was there a sharp intake of breath? Did eyebrows go north? Did people immediately climb on the bandwagon? What was the feedback?
We just had fantastic support. I mean, I don't know. I think we were lucky in that I feel as though the idea of rewilding, the idea that we need to be more connected to the natural environment and that it's particularly good for children, has just been bubbling up for a while. And obviously there are loads of great people doing wonderful work in this area, not least you. But I think we were lucky in that we just kind of hit the right timing. So we got a broadcaster on board really soon, Channel 4 in the UK. And then suddenly these organisations began wanting to be involved. And it was hugely exciting to see big organisations like the National Trust in the UK, which has 4 million members, and the RSPB, the Scouts, the Guides, the Woodland Trust, the Wildlife Trusts, they just started joining. And then not just them, but mental health charities and the NHS Sustainability Unit. And so there was a big health element. And then the educationalists began to get interested, like forest schools. But not just forest schools, all kinds of schools from around the UK started joining up. And when I say joining up, when we were doing the campaign in the film, as you'll see, we were encouraging people to join the movement. And that's now kind of turned into this thing called the Wild Network, which is free to join still. And if anyone's listening and they want to get involved in the campaign, please join the Wild Network. But it was just very quickly evident that there was a big appetite for a banner, a really simple banner under which people could march. Mm-hmm. And the banner would say on it something really simple, like children ought to be outdoors more. And if you make that your motto, it's amazing the kind of range of groups that are interested in mm-hmm. making that true.
One of the things in the film that really gave me a jolt was when you were sitting in a classroom asking pupils, all girls, I think, who were maybe 14, 15, what they felt about nature. And they found it dirty, dangerous, faintly abhorrent, didn't they? And is that... I mean, was that a particular demographic, do you think? Or is that something that's happened right across the board with childhood, that we've inculcated them with this notion that somehow the great outdoors is no longer great, that it's a dank and dirty and dangerous place to be avoided?
Isn't it? It was so sad, that scene. I know the one you're talking about. And I still feel really sorry for those girls, but I see it a lot. I don't think it's a demographic thing. Mm-hmm. I definitely don't think it's a city versus urban thing. I don't think it's a rich versus poor thing.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly at that age group, early teens, a lot of children just feel as though there's something deeply uncool about the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the messaging they're getting is about looking beautiful, being strong if you're a boy, looking beautiful if you're a girl, being connected socially at all times, a huge amount of pressure to be constantly on social networks. And I'm going to say it, I think that they're being prepared to be good consumers by the brands. The brands are beginning to get to them to persuade them that nothing that's free could possibly have any value. Nothing that's on your doorstep could possibly have any value. What you want, they're told, is to aspire for stuff that's kind of unachievable, aspiring for beauty and wealth and all of these things. So no, I felt very sorry for them. I think a lot of those kids, as they age, they come back to the natural world, especially if they've been shown it when they were young.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm afraid a lot of those kids wouldn't have been shown it when they were young, and so maybe they'll never really make that connection.
Yeah.
I don't, by the way, think that they're a lost cause, that age group, but I do think if you want to market nature to children, it's good to aim young. Because at that young stage, children really develop their initial sensations about whether they're going to find nature to be a comfortable place or not. Mm-hmm. And as you saw, those kids were scared by nature. You know, they read in their local paper every day about violent dogs mauling people in the park, or they'd read about paedophiles snatching children from street corners. And so from their point of view, safer in the bedroom. And of course, in the bedroom, it's easier for them to be marketed to as well. You know, they can consume more electronic games.
So yeah. And of course, there's another irony there as well, which is that you can never really remove or edit all risk out of a child's life. If you wall them up indoors and raise them in captivity, they will come across other dangers. So I stumbled across a fact which I found both amusing and horrifying recently, which is that in Britain now, children are 3 times more likely to get hurt falling out of a bed than falling out of a tree, which I think really sums up a bit where we are at the moment.
That's a terrifying thought. And one of the stats that I really love, because a lot of parents say to me, oh, you know, I'm trying to get my kid to be a good, you know, I want him to be a good businessman and make lots of money when he's older. And that, so it's great that he's on the screen, you know, kind of focusing on computers. For parents who say that to me, which a few have, I always like to tell them about the study that showed that 80% of successful entrepreneurs were tree climbers when they were kids. Mm-hmm. There's something about that risk-taking ability to deal with an asymmetrical natural world that is very useful mm-hmm. for going on to be a good businessman. So,
and that kind of asymmetrical challenge can never really be fully replicated, I don't think, by an app, can it? Because it's always been filtered through the mind, the aesthetic sensibility of a human being, a designer somewhere in London or New York or California or wherever. It's never that kind of randomness of nature, is it? There's always an algorithm at work somewhere below the surface.
Well, that's right. And I think it's very interesting that something like Minecraft has elements of that randomness about it, an asymmetrical, you know, surprising nature. Mm-hmm. And it's a very attractive game for kids. I find Minecraft particularly scary. I don't mind saying it. I mean, I've played it, I understand it, I get the attraction. What I find scary about it is that elements of the attraction of Minecraft are very cleverly similar to the mm-hmm. elements of attraction of the natural world. You know, it's about exploring, it's about using the resources that you find when you're exploring, it's about the unpredictability that might mm-hmm. happen. So yeah, I'm particularly wary of those kinds of games that are kind of aping the natural world in a sense. And
stealing your robes.
I think they're stealing my stuff. Yeah. As the marketing director of nature, I should be suing those
You've
guys.
You've got to be quick and nimble in this marketing war game, don't you? I mean, one of the things I think about nature is, I see it as you know, the original playground, but also the original classroom. You know, that we are hardwired, really, to go out. And you have a lot of wonderful examples in the film of how people looking at green spaces from a hospital bed get better more quickly, and all these sort of natural benefits that we derive from any kind of contact with the natural world. You used the phrase earlier, lost cause. Do you think any children are lost causes when it comes to recreating that bond with, that sacred bond with nature?
No, I absolutely don't. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence that at any age, whatever kind of experience you've had of the natural world, even if it's been very limited, you can still derive a huge amount of benefit from time spent outdoors. So you don't need to have learnt it. In fact, sometimes, and I tell this to the organisations that I'm about to be rude about, but you know, sometimes big nature-based and ecology organisations, they kind of make it out like they're the experts, and that wild places is are things that kind of geographers and people with cagoules and the right wet weather clothing should be allowed into, but the rest of us should just, you know, go somewhere else and not disturb the wildlife. Mm-hmm. You know, actually the evidence is we should all, you know, we can all derive a huge amount of benefit from that. So no, there aren't lost causes, but I do think, and this you know, anyone who's listening who's got young, particularly very young kids, I do think that if you get them into it young, you'll have them, that they'll have a lifelong love of the natural world. It's mm-hmm. harder the older you are to persuade kids that it's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've made this film in Britain, and it's been pitched, the movement, I gather, the network has really gathered steam here in this country chiefly, is that right? Or has it made ripples elsewhere?
Yeah, well, I mean, excitingly, we're beginning to spread out. So there's mm-hmm. a kind of, we've got a chapter, a kind of group, part of the movement out in Australia now and part in the US.
Has the film been screened there?
The film's been screened in quite a few countries mm-hmm. now. So it's exciting to see that happen. But you're right, the home of the Wild Network at the moment mm-hmm. is definitely the UK.
And is that because we need it more here than other countries, do you think? I mean, I know one of the points made in the film is that somehow our nature deficit is more acute. Is that real?
I do think it's real, and I think it's not simple why that is. Mm. I think it relates to a number of barriers that we've very efficiently put up in the UK between children and the natural world. And it ranges from a press that that reports a huge amount on these terrible stories that mm-hmm. you hear about children going missing or being abducted. It ranges from that to a very, very full-on work ethic we have here, right, where parents are quite often just don't have time, mm-hmm. or they see time spent outside doing nothing, which, by the way, is what children report as being the ultimate pleasure that they get from spending time with adults, is time outdoors with people they love in non-directed play. Mm. If you can do that with kids, they're happy, basically. It's what they want. But we're kind of too busy for that in the UK. And then we've got problems with, our car lobby is sort of crazy. It's full of Jeremy Clarksons who want to kind of own the world in their cars. And so, you know, we haven't really contained roads in a very effective way. Our political and educational system is very goal-based, so we don't have very much learning outside the classroom in things. I mean, I've just named four. We've listed about 13 barriers that we think Britain has put up really effectively. So it's a complicated thing. But before you feel disheartened about it, I always say, well, the great news is that to erode all of those barriers, all you need to do is go outdoors. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of silver bullet solution
to
all of this.
It's a simple just, key here.
Yeah, just turn. get out more.
Yeah. You mentioned that that children, what they cherish most is those, what was the word you used, sort of undirected, relaxed time outdoors with
adults they love.
Yeah. Which is what people have always done throughout human history, just been pottering around in the garden or outside. And sometimes the parents are there, sometimes they're not, or they're there, but they're kind of light touch at a distance and so on. But it's not always just the fact that parents are busy and don't have the time to allow that to happen. There's something else has happened culturally, hasn't it? That people regard that kind of play as a waste of time. It's not, you can't put undirected, relaxed play outdoors on a CV or a university application or a job interview claim. You know, it just doesn't fit the achievement model that's become so prevalent, not just in the UK, I think, and it's something I find around the world. Does that jive with your take?
Totally, Carl. I mean, I have to say, I like the way you put that. I've not heard it quite put quite like that before. I mean, there's something about the idea of just doing nothing in the outdoors that it really doesn't suit a CV. It wouldn't look good, right, would it, to say, you know, interests, chilling out outdoors. Mm-hmm. Although it should do. It should be a sign of great mental depth.
Yeah.
So sadly,
an entrepreneurial spirit.
Spirit. But I wanted to say that. I think that's the key point. If you think about this idea that children constantly need to be learning the next thing, okay, well, we're outdoors, so we're going to learn about, we're going to learn about these kinds of seashells, and it's, you know, everything becomes a lesson, everything has a learning outcome. And it's all very well to prepare children in that way if you want them to be factually led in their learning. But, you know, there's a huge amount of evidence that for flexibility in an uncertain world, nothing beats some space and time for children to develop in a slightly less structured, more dreamlike way when they're outdoors. And nature is the best place, as you said earlier. It's the best playground to teach that kind of flexibility.
Well, Virginia Woolf described, she talked about the great cathedral space, which was childhood. And I think, go back probably 20 years, and everyone would have had that experience. We talked about it a little bit at the beginning, that sense of the world being a big place. You open the front door and out you went. It was your world. There were no grown-ups. Adults got out of the way. You were out for the morning and you hear your mum shouting lunch, you'd come back, same again at dinner. Whereas now it's very much more regimented and you have those narrow circles and you don't have that space. Maybe what also gets sacrificed is just the independent spirit. I mean, the kind of curiosity, because if you're always being told to achieve this or find the other thing, you lose that art of peripheral vision, of just opening up to that great cathedral space and soaking it up and filtering it and coming up with your own take on the world, which, let's face it, we're always being told by business people and politicians that we need people who think outside the box. And yet what we seem to be raising is a generation of children who are really good at ticking the box.
I totally agree with that. I think that starts right at birth. If you take, I don't know if you've looked online, but you know, you can buy kind of kids' strollers and even kids' potties that have iPad holders attached to them. So when your little darling is going to the loo, he or she can watch the iPad. And similarly, in the stroller, you can have the iPad. That kind of laser-like focus that you're encouraging by encouraging children to focus downwards and inwards on this small screen with action happening in two dimensions on this small screen is really the antithesis of what time in the natural world can give you, because there's something incredibly resolute and panoramic about the natural world. If you, you know, next time you're looking up at a tree canopy lying on the grass, just consider the complexity of the image that you're seeing. It's virtually impossible for computer games to recreate that, mm-hmm. even with the fantastic graphics cards that we have yeah. now. And children, particularly young children's brains, get a massive benefit from that sort of level of visual complexity. Don't give your kids iPads to look at when they're tiny. Give them trees. It's definitely better for their brains.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's the advice given by the associations for pediatricians in both Canada and the United States. And that's the official advice, the official line. But of course, it's not what you see when you go out in the streets and playgrounds and living rooms and bedrooms, is it? You see these.
Well, it's ironic, I think, that a lot of the countries in which the kind of official line, like the US, Canada, and the UK, the official line is that it is good for children to be, you know, have time outdoors mm. and all the rest of it. But they tend to be the countries where, if you look at the amount of time that kids spend outdoors in those countries, it's very low. I mean, the UK and the US are both right down at the bottom of the league table in terms of children mm. roaming and playing outdoors. So, maybe we're just salving our conscience by, letting the experts tell us that.
Mm. There's an irony here, isn't there? Because you've got an app for the Wild Thing project, and I'm sure it comes up time and time again, that using technology to persuade children to leave technology behind. Was that something you found disconcerting at the beginning, or did it just seem natural? Is it a surrender in a way, or is it just common sense to use the technology to wean people off the technology, if you like?
Well, I've never really seen a child using that app indoors, so I'm really proud that that app seems to have a high level of usage in the outdoors, because mm-hmm. kids take it outdoors.
But they must fire it up indoors when they find, we've got half an hour now, where's the iPad?
Oh, right,
they immediately
yes.
go outside,
well,
you're saying?
Well, they tend to, or maybe they'll look through and see if they can find something that they're keen on doing. So
maybe we should explain how this app works.
Yeah, let me explain, So it's called the Wild Time app, and it's we basically asked lots and lots of our members to share great ideas mm-hmm. of short activities to do outside, divided into time frames. So, you know, you've got 30 seconds or a minute or mm-hmm. 5 minutes or up to half a day. And we got a whole bunch of recommendations of really crazy activities, mm-hmm. Which, you know, people should go and have a look at. And lots of families are using it, and kids are using it to generate ideas for things to do.
Can you share a couple of the ones?
Sure.
You like
so
most?
I mean, you know, one of my favourite ones with my son when he was a couple of years ago. We used to play leaf snap all the time. It's like snap with cards, except you use leaves. So we go outside and find pairs of leaves, a pair of oak leaves, a pair of sycamore leaves, uh-huh. And then we had these really heated games uh-huh. of leaf snap, which he loved. And I didn't really do it for this because I'm not much of an expert on leaf types and tree types, even myself. But as a result of playing it, he now goes around going, oh, I know what that leaf is. So it turned out to be a kind of educational thing as well. So that's one example. We do snail racing. One of the things I play with the kids a lot is trying to move around without disturbing wildlife. So we kind of do stealthy movements when mm-hmm. we're out in parks and see how close we can get to birds and things like that. And that's just such a simple idea.
Like nature ninjas.
I guess we're nature ninjas, maybe. That's it. Exactly. So there's loads of ideas like that. And I think it's an example. I hope it's an example of good technology. It's a kind of technology that gets you thinking and it gets you physically active. So, I think what's more dodgy about what we did was making an 80-minute movie about getting kids outdoors. Because I guess, you know, we know that quite a few million people have watched it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've kind of contributed to the screen time there. But I've kind of salved my conscience by saying, oh, well, it's just a one-off movie and hopefully people who watch it will be inspired to be outdoors. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's certainly very inspiring. Is it a one-off? Is there something else in the pipeline to follow it up? Or now are you thinking more offline in your thrust to make this happen?
Well, the Wild Network is continuing and doing really well and going from strength to strength. So that's happening still. Lots of people are still watching the original movie. And we're also developing a spin-off series, which we hope will kind of be an ongoing celebration of wild mm-hmm. spaces in Britain and wild activities for families. So we've kind of, I seem to have found a campaign that's, well, it's very addictive. It's a very interesting space to be in. And it feels like it's one of those ones that's very sustaining. Sometimes when you end up making a film or getting, you know, wound up by a movement or involved in a movement, it kind of feels like it's right for now, but maybe it won't be right in the future. But there's something about, I don't know, wild natural spaces, time outside that feels like it's probably going to be good for
it's
me.
It's not going anywhere.
It's not going
it?
Anywhere. Yeah. Right? I'm hoping, you know, fingers crossed I'll be out walking the Yorkshire Dales when I'm in my 90s.
With a camera?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. and recognizing leaves, presumably, as
well. If I can still see them.
So is this your full-time, are you doing other projects that don't have anything to do with Wild Thing, or is this really what you do now? Is your calling, your vocation, your full-time job?
Yeah, right now, very focused on Project Wild Thing, which is great. It's become a kind of mild obsession in a way that I really enjoy. But I'm so interested in the way that it crosses over with so many other issues. So, for example, there's the issue of access to land, which obviously asks lots of questions about, you know, our right to roam and our right to get out into green spaces. And then it's got a huge amount also to do with the slow movement. You know, it's asking questions about our relationship with commerciality and how busy and hectic our lives are. So it feels like a good space to be in. It's a space that's connected to a lot of other
spaces. Takes you in lots to different domains, doesn't it? In fact, my next question was, it's one thing to help families get children out of the home and into the... That can feel quite micro, can't it, I suppose, in a way. But there are some bigger macro changes that have to occur for this to stick, don't there? I mean, taking on, for instance, the consumption, military, industrial complex, you know, all of that kind of thing. And the way that neighborhoods operate now. I mean, that was one of the things that struck me very much in the film, was those two boys talking about never going to the park that was just down the road and feeling that they didn't know anyone in the neighborhood and that could lead to aggression and bullying and so on. And it's so different from the kind of childhood I think most people probably from the age of 35 and over remember, which is one where all of the kids roam around the neighborhood. You knew everybody's face. You probably knew most of their names. They would be different ages. But there was a sense of people knowing who they were, and possibly the corollary of that being that they were looking out for each other. And it just created that sense that when you open the front door, what spilled out in front of you was not an endless cesspool of pedophiles and drunk drivers and, you know, dangerous bacteria, but a community.
I think you're right, although I totally agree with what you just said, but I feel as though the kind of our obsession with private space, like we all need to be tucked away in our own bedrooms, consuming our own media and connecting with each other through social networks. That's the kind of model that makes us into the most useful economic units. You know, go to work, earn some money, and then spend it kind of ideally without physically making any mess. Mm-hmm. And I still feel like being outdoors in public space, particularly or in shared space, is such a wonderful way to stick two fingers up at the commercial military industrial complex, as you put it, because when you're outdoors, it's very hard to be sold to. You know, there aren't that many billboard ads in London that, you know, if you go to Hyde Park or many of the parks, you're safe from advertising. And so it's a great anti-capitalist maneuver, as I sort of jokingly said in the film.
But rightly, I think.
To go outdoors. And similarly, the studies show that people who meet in natural environments tend to demonstrate much lower prejudices about race, and about educational background and social background. And that's something about the leveling nature of the natural world. Yeah. You know, when we meet in the natural world, I don't have anything to judge you by. You're just another human in this natural space. And it just makes it easier to connect. So I don't want to make it sound like this is easy, because it's not. But if we were all to be outdoors more, and we were all connecting rather more in the outside world, then elements of that commercialization would have to die away, by definition. And similarly, elements of the kind of fear and separation of communities would also die away. I mean, one of the members of the Wild Network is this fantastic organization that closes streets down and gets children out and playing in them. And that has such an overwhelmingly positive effect on communities. So anyone listening who wants to close their local street and organize a play day...
that called? It's a wonderful group that I...
Playing Out. Yeah,
they're Playing Out as well?
Playing Out, yeah. So, you know, get in touch with them or get in touch with us at the Wild Network, and we can, you know, one of the things we see our role as being amplifying these cool projects that are happening around the UK.
And they are happening more and more, and not just around the UK. You get these projects everywhere. I just read a fascinating piece about a city in South Korea which banned cars for a whole month, and gave people electric scooters and just completely changed the whole urban landscape for a month. And it engineered a social revolution. I mean, it just suddenly community that hadn't been there sprouted up again, and they've gone back. And now other cities are looking at doing the same thing. And it's one thing to close off a city to cars for a Sunday, which many cities do now. It's quite another for it to do it for a whole month, because it actually forces people to make real deep changes in their behavior. And once they do get a taste of what it's like to walk down streets that aren't clogged with cars, to see other people, to bump into them physically, to be in that shared space, then they don't want to go back. That's, I think, quite telling and also optimistic, is it not? I mean,
it's an amazing idea. I mean, it's a bit like the, you know, the closing a street writ large across across the city, and it's a wonderful idea. The problem we have in the UK, and I don't mean to sound cynical, but I think we'll wait a long time before any of the likely governments that we're going to have over the next few years are going to raise this high up on the agenda. I can't imagine the Conservative government in the UK right now is deciding, okay, you know, time for children to play outdoors or time for communities to reconnect in outdoor environments is high on our agenda.
Has it been a deafening silence then from the political world to the project? I mean, you talked about health and education, a lot of interest there, but in the political sphere, not so much?
In a way, we've not tried to reach out too hard to it. And the reason is that I think we see ourselves, the Wild Network, as being quite a grassroots movement. And the idea that we need Westminster or the Houses of Parliament to wave a magic wand and fix this problem is, well, A, it's not going to happen, and B, I think it would somehow, I don't know, in a strange way, devalue the joy of being outdoors if we're kind of being politically instructed to do it. I think one of the wonderful things about the outdoors is that it's a kind of place where you're safe from...
It's free of spin doctors.
It's free of spin doctors. Yes. It's free of kind of social engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So I quite like it being politician-free at the moment.
Mm-hmm. One of the happiest moments I had in London, I'm sure you had it yourself, was about 5 years ago. Do you remember? It snowed for 3 days, and the city was just closed down. The airport stopped. There were no buses. Nobody went to work. And I remember the common near our house in Battersea, it was Clapham Common, just filled with children and adults and people building snowmen, and it was like a Bruegel, you know, it's got to be a medieval peasant carnival atmosphere, and it was just extraordinary, and it showed you, people still talk about that time as it's part of the local folklore, and it does show, it seems to me, that need, that hunger, that desire, that simple joy is there for all of us to be tapped into. It's just a shame we need to have a weather shutdown to make it come about, but I suppose maybe we don't because we've got projects like Wild Thing that are nudging us in that direction anyway.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I mean, certainly, you know, the evidence is that just a tiny bit of outdoor wild time every day has a huge positive benefit on children and adults. And it's very easy to make that change in your life. We're not asking people to go and live wild in the woods and kind of, you know, scavenge for their own food. You know, it's simply that couple of minutes in the morning when you notice that the tree that's outside your window has changed in this particular way since yesterday. And even just a moment to consider that with your family or the people around you is hugely beneficial.
Mm-hmm. A couple of final questions. We talked a little bit about how childhood has been that free-range childhood that our generation and earlier generations enjoyed. Do you think that we can ever get back to that in its entirety, or are we looking at bringing back some elements of it and balancing them with something that's very new and very 21st century, which will be a bit more indoors and a bit more screen-based?
I agree that with the change and the technology that we now see, it's likely that childhood will always have this element of connecting through screens, and I think that's fine in its place. But I'm really excited by the idea that more children outdoors, which is what we're beginning to see. I think we've reached the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to a point where it's almost impossible to give children any more screen time. You know, the average 8 to 12 year old in the UK is doing 6 hours a day. I mean, any more than that, and it's kind of, that would be cruelty. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd get arrested.
Yeah.
So we've reached the bottom, and we're going to see a growth in children outdoors. We're going to see a growth in families and children outdoors. And that is wonderful because it tends to go in a virtuous circle. You know, the more people who are outdoors, the more people who want to feel like they're outdoors, the more the local authority has to do to provide safe spaces and all the rest of it. So no, I look forward to a really happy future in which my children are bringing up their kids in a city where they can roam much more widely than my children can at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Are your children, who are now what age?
They're now 6 and 7.
6 and 7. So are they aware that they are the offspring of the leading crusader for a wild man dad? Do they know what you've done and what you're doing? And have they seen and commented on changes in their own lives since this whole project got rolling?
Yeah, they're they keep me pretty level. They tease me and say, Ivy said to me the other day, "Daddy, now that you've finished making Project Wealth Thing, can I watch more telly, please?" So, you know, she knows how to wind me up. But, you know, they know they're in the film, and they're proud of me. I'm really flattered to say that it's been a good experience. You know, mm-hmm. I think they think of it as being a slightly weird, you know, thing to do. Daddy goes to work trying to make children go outdoors.
You started off with that pie chart, the time pie chart, and your daughter was 4% outdoors. What is it now, would you say?
We measured her last year, so this is a year out of date, mm-hmm. these stats. And I'm pretty sure it's grown since then, but she was at 15% last year. So I'm really hoping this year, where she's been physically a bit bigger, she's tougher, so she's prepared to go outside when it's, you know, she mm-hmm. takes herself outdoors when it's right. colder now.
Yeah.
Whereas before, maybe she mm-hmm. wouldn't so much. So I'm hoping we may be heading for 20%. It's not as much as my mum 80 years ago, but it'll do.
It's a lot more than 4%.
It's a lot more than 4%.
Is there a universal sweet spot? Is 20% what parents listening to this should all be aspiring to? Or does it depend on age, time of year?
Well, the first thing I'd say to people is don't feel like it's another thing that you've got mm. to measure and worry about,
yeah.
right? Because I think as soon as you turn the outside into a thing that has to be done on the tick
plop
list,
it on a graph,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
It kind of takes the joy away. I mean, I did it because I was interested, because I'd measured her in the film and I wanted to do it again. So really, I'd say as much as possible, and as much as is enjoyable as well. But to begin with, just a tiny bit every day. Mm-hmm. Something about everyday wild time that is so beneficial. I think a lot of parents are really good, and I used to be this kind of parent, really good at saying, right, once a year, we're going to go to Snowdonia and go camping, and we're going to climb up Mount Snowdon and see the mm-hmm. da-da-da-da-da, and then we can come home again and watch more telly. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think as I've developed maybe as a parent or become more aware of this issue, I've got better and better at saying, okay, we've got 5 minutes, let's go and check on the goldfinch nest at the bottom of the garden and see whether mm-hmm. they're, you know, whether those chicks are born yet. And that's something that is just really easy to do in a minute.
Little small doses.
Tiny yeah. doses. Yeah.
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 Is there, just to round out, is there anything you want to throw into the mix, or any question you want to answer that I've not put to you, or have you said your bit?
No, I mean, I just wanted to say it's really nice to talk to you, and I feel that our projects are very aligned in an interesting way. I think the idea that there's something deeply calming, deeply restorative and slow about time spent in the natural mm. world is very, very important. Certainly the time I've spent outdoors in the last few years since making the film has been some of the happiest times of my life. And that's partly because I've been made aware of the value of it by people, you know, writing about it in the way that you do and lots of other people do. I hope we can stay connected, and I just say to your listeners that you should get outdoors as much as possible.
Well, I'm all for that. I second that emotion. So on that note, I'll say thank you very much, David Bond, for making the time. It's been a real pleasure, and long may the Wild Thing project live long and prosper.
Thank you, Cole.